So I'm just going to set the scene for you, okay? It's 16 years ago. It's 16 years ago. It's May 1996. Spring flowers are blooming. The blossom is on the trees. The sap is rising. There's great anticipation in the air. After a 30-year wait, football is coming home. The European Championships are less than a month away, and optimism for a home victory under El Tel is high. I'm excited, but not just by the football. Important as that is, I'm excited because finally, after years of prevarication and procrastination, I'm about to take the plunge and walk through the doors of the Brighton Buddhist Centre. I got as far as the doors 9 years earlier, but no further. But here I am again. Here I am, taking the decisive step. Impelled by one existential crisis too many, there's no turning back. In I go, into an atmosphere that's different, but at the same time, familiar and reassuring. There's a faint smell of incense and an inscription above the door. Sabbe Sata Sukhi Hontu. May all beings be well. May all beings be happy. It feels like coming home. Finally, I've entered the oasis after years of wandering in the desert. And what did I find there? What did I find in the Brighton Buddhist Centre? Well, I found warmth. I found kindness, positivity, humour. But most importantly, I found affirmation that there were solutions. There were actual solutions to the major existential issues confronting a human being. I found wisdom. More particularly, I found the Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha. The Dharma is the means by which the Buddha sought to communicate the wisdom of the enlightened mind to the unenlightened. So whilst the great existential philosophers of the Western tradition were very good at flagging up and highlighting the critical situation the human being found themselves in, it appeared to me, and from my sort of research and reading, that none of them appeared to have found any kind of viable solution to that predicament. By way of contrast, for the Buddha, the existential situation is merely the starting point of a journey leading ultimately to its complete transcendence. The Buddha said, I teach two things. I teach suffering and the end of suffering. So the conditions which lead to the arising and continuation of suffering are set out in the 12 Nidana sequence of conditionality. And this is famously depicted in the Tibetan Wheel of Life. And of course the first nidana, upon which the whole of this mass of suffering arises, is ignorance, the polar opposite of wisdom. However, although ignorance is the first link in the chain of becoming, the Buddha is clear that it's not a first cause. Indeed, like the other nidanas, it arises and is maintained in dependence upon conditions. And he indicates that the nutriment for ignorance is through not hearing the true Dharma by associating with people of no integrity. And he goes on, and what bhikkhus is ignorance? Not knowing suffering, not knowing the origin of suffering, not knowing the cessation of suffering, and not knowing the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called ignorance. So in other words, ignorance amounts to ignorance of the Four Noble Truths themselves. And it's through not hearing the Dharma that we are ignorant of these four Ariyasakas. And we remain ignorant so long as we associate with other people who are ignorant. And as a result of entering the portals of the Brighton Buddhist Centre, I was taught the Four Noble Truths. And finally, after so many years of false dawns and cul-de-sacs, I was in touch with, inverted commas, the wise. For this is what order members seemed to me. They had access to the teachings of the Buddha, and not only that, but they were putting them into practice and had been doing so for many years. They'd been living by the teachings of the Buddha. And they were running this centre, which existed solely for the purpose of providing people with a means to seek enlightenment. It was a centre for enlightenment seekers. Now, traditionally, the wise are those practitioners who are known as stream entrants, once returners, non-returners, and arahants. So it may be the order members who taught me the Dharma were not part of the Arya Sangha, although some of them may be. They were, however, wise in comparison to most of the people that I usually associated with. So, I was taught the Four Noble Truths, and the first truth is the truth of dukkha, the truth of suffering, the truth of unsatisfactoriness. Now, this often seems by its detractors to be indicative that Buddhism is somehow pessimistic, that it errs on the dark side of things. But as Bhante Sangharakshita says, Buddhism is neither pessimistic nor optimistic, but rather melioristic, by which melioristic means that our situation may be improved by our own efforts. Indeed, in presenting the Dharma, the Buddha is not seeking to express an opinion. Rather, he is telling us how it is. So dukkha is not merely an interpretation of events. It is a fact about the nature of conditioned things. So the Buddha's most fundamental teaching is that of paticca-samuppada, translated as conditioned arising or conditioned co-production. Essentially, it means that everything arises in dependence upon conditions. So, according to this principle, all phenomena, be they mental or material, arise in dependence upon conditions and cease when those supporting conditions cease. Nothing inherently exists as a freestanding entity. Every phenomena is a multiplicity of conditions, a process, a continuum. Any appearance of static entities is an illusion. A mountain at any given moment may appear static, but the blades of grass on its slope are growing or dying, streams flow, rocks are eroded by wind and water, and due to shifts in the earth's crust, the mountain may be imperceptibly increasing or decreasing in height. No thing endures even for a split second. So it follows from this that all things are completely impermanent and have no enduring substance or self. Indeed, one of the things I heard early on in my time at the Brighton Buddhist Centre was that I was a process and not an entity. I was a non-entity. Steady on. So initially that might be somewhat disquieting, but actually it contains a very strong positive message, particularly for someone like me, who believed that I was flawed in particular ways. It meant that I could change. Indeed, it meant that I was change. I am change. However, the downside is that whatever is conditioned or compounded will end, is subject to change and decay. Consequently, it follows that if we are physically and psychologically dependent upon that which is subject to dissolution and decay, then we're going to suffer. So the Buddha indicated that the three marks of all conditioned things is that they are impermanent, anicca, unsatisfactory, dukkha, and insubstantial or non-self, anatta. Which takes us back to the first noble truth. As the Buddha says, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering. Association with the unpleasant is suffering. Dissociation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to receive what one desires is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to grasping are suffering. And the five aggregates are what make up the psychophysical organism. So they're what we take ourselves to be. They're what we grasp onto in order to give us a sense of self. So in his survey of Buddhism, Bhante Sangharakshita poses the question, well, why did the Buddha start his teaching with the fact of suffering? And he comes to the following conclusion. By beginning with the fact of pain, Buddhism involves the whole of the nature of man from the outset. Recognition of the first noble truth comes not as a pleasant intellectual diversion, but as a terrible emotional shock. The scripture says that one feels then like a man who suddenly realizes that his turban is in flames. And it's only a shock of this kind that is strong enough to galvanize the whole being into action. So of course the truth of dukkha is an unpalatable one, and consequently one that we tend to shy away from. It's a truth that most people try to ignore, to remain unaware of. Indeed, most people seek to maintain distorted views, or viparyasas, about the nature of reality, by seeing conditioned things as substantial, permanent, pleasurable, and beautiful. And these views are based in and are productive of ignorance, and as such act as the nutriment for craving and aversion. Interestingly, Nanamoli and Bhikkhu Bodhi translate viparyasa as mental derangement, which is perhaps communicates more strongly the nature of the delusion involved. However, no matter how much we try and ignore it or deny it, reality will inevitably impinge upon us at some point in our lives. This may be in the form of death. It may be in the form of death of someone close to us. Sorry, that doesn't make sense, doesn't it? If we die, yeah. Anyway, it's in the form of death of someone close to us. The breakup of a relationship, the loss of a job or a serious illness. And it's often these events that actually lead us through the door of our local Buddhist centre. I think for me it was an accumulation of upsets and disappointments over years. But the final tipping point, which projected me through the doors of the Brighton Buddhist Centre, was the possibility that I had a malignancy in my spine. A biopsy revealed that this was not actually the case, but the days of waiting for the results to come through was a direct encounter with the reality of my own mortality. So I was determined, whatever the outcome, not to waste any more time on the ephemeral things of life. And this, of course, may not be the case for everyone. Some people are just very inspired with a Buddhist vision. But more often than not, it's the encounter with the reality of dukkha and reflection on that that galvanizes us to seek out something different. As the Buddha said, and what is the result of suffering? There are some cases in which a person overcome with pain, his mind exhausted, grieves, mourns, laments, beats his breast and becomes bewildered. Or one overcome with pain, his mind exhausted, comes to search outside. Who knows a way or two to stop this pain? I tell you, monks, that suffering results either in bewilderment or in search. So the search is one that leads us through the doors of the Buddhist centre for the first time. And it may well be that when we encounter the wisdom of the Buddha's first noble truth, that we experience a sense of relief. Relief that the presence of suffering and happiness and discontent in our life is not the result of some quirk of circumstance or personal limitation, but is ubiquitous to the human situation. Thus one discovers that it's not confined to oneself, but is experienced by everyone to greater or lesser degrees. Everyone is subject to suffering. And perhaps this realization begins to move us out of the prison of our self-obsession and towards a genuine concern for other people. Indeed, we may begin to feel a kinship, a solidarity with other people. We realise that we're all in the same boat, even if, as one Zen master said, the boat is sinking. Indeed, if we keep going to the Buddhist centre, something remarkable happens. We're taught the metta bhavana. Barely have we got through the door and we're being taught to develop and radiate metta to all beings throughout the universe. Now, we may take that for granted now, because that's what we do. But we should never lose sight of the fact that it's actually totally revolutionary. If you think about it, if everyone in the world did the metta bhavana, what would the world be like? It'd be a totally different place. And it'd not only be qualitatively different, but it'd actually be physically different. And I know this is something that Daniel's going to maybe explore a bit tomorrow. But back to the wisdom, of the Four Noble Truths. Wisdom doesn't come about from simply acknowledging that dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, suffering. But it comes from reflecting upon it and deeply meditating upon it. And the Buddha indicated that the task for us in relation to the First Noble Truth is to comprehend it to the point of dispassion. So that is by seeing the absolute contingency of all conditioned things, we sit much looser to them. And actually we do this by becoming mindful of impermanence. And the more aware we become of impermanence, of everything in every moment, then it slowly dawns on us that nothing can be relied upon. Nothing can bring lasting satisfaction. There is actually no security into which we can make ourselves comfortable and settle down. Everything is dissolving even as it arises. And this eventually leads to renunciation. Now, renunciation is not a force giving up things, but rather it emerges out of a disenchantment with those things to which we are attached. And disenchantment is produced by seeing that, because everything is impermanent, all conditioned things are potential sources of dukkha. And the more attached we are to them, the more attached we are to things that end, the more painful that is when that happens. So seeing clearly in this way, our passion for them is cooled, and our desire for them falls away. And this dispassion arises out of disenchantment. And the state of dispassion is not of cold indifference, but is of a deep, deep equanimity that knows how things are and is no longer troubled by them. This is traditionally known as the liberation of wishlessness or the unbiased. Having seen dukkha intrinsic in all compounded things, one's volitional energies no longer move towards them. One is no longer impelled to pursue them. And this is a serene state of being. As the Buddha's Second Noble Truth tells us, the origin of suffering is craving. As he says, it is this craving, thirst, which produces re-becoming, rebirth, accompanied by passionate greed and finding fresh delight, now here and now there, namely craving for sense pleasure, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. So with just a little reflection, we can see that to be in a state of wanting is to be in a state of agitation. One's consciousness narrows down. One becomes constricted. One can only focus on the things that one wants. Everything else becomes peripheral, is brushed aside, moved out of awareness. Thoughts become repetitive, compulsive, and anxiety-ridden. Because desire is always accompanied by fear. The fear, the anxiety, that one will not get what one wants. Now this may simply be on the level of the last piece of cake, or it may be that one will not meet one's dream partner and get to live happily ever after. But these are painful states of mind, and if maintained over a period of time, become potentially debilitating. Craving is a centrifugal force which keeps us locked in the delusion of a small, limited self and the suffering that that produces. It's the engine of becoming, the fuel by which the illusion of a fixed self, the ego, is maintained. So the task the Buddha sets us in relation to the origin of suffering is to abandon it, abandon craving. So for us, it's a question of being more mindful of the arising of thoughts and impulses which would drive us on in search of something outside of ourselves to relieve our sense of boredom or sense of dissatisfaction. But these thoughts are conditionally arisen. They're ephemeral, impermanent, insubstantial. They're not me, they're not mine, they're not self. And if we can begin to see them in this way, we can get interested in the process whereby they're produced and disappear, and we're less inclined to act on their imperative. And instead, a space opens up, a space in which contentment can emerge. So with contentment, there emerges peace, calm, happiness, and not surprisingly deeper states of meditation, which reinforce these positive states. But crucially, contentment undermines craving. So we can contrast the state of contentment with a state of wanting and perception of lack. We can really begin to see the suffering inherent in craving. As I said, to crave is actually to be in a state of suffering. Wanting, not wanting, they're both painful states. And seeing this suffering clearly leads to disenchantment with objects and the impulses of craving. And the more we do so, the closer we move to realizing the third noble truth, which is, in the Buddha's words, the complete cessation of that very craving, giving it up, relinquishing it, liberating oneself from it, and detaching oneself from it. So with the end of craving, there's no longer grasping and the insatiable impulse towards re-becoming, whether in each moment or over innumerable lifetimes. We stop the wheel of life in its tracks. So it's important to be aware of the principle of cessation and to experience it directly in your own life. Which brings me back to the Brighton Buddhist Centre and the wisdom imparted to me there. After I'd been going there a little while, I kept hearing people talking about the need to sit in the gap. And apparently they were not talking about a shop or Burley Gap on the way to Eastbourne. The gap was a phrase coined by Banti in his talk on the mind reactive and creative, and denotes the gap between the arising of a feeling and our usual response to the feeling, which in the case of a pleasant feeling is normally to grab hold of it and look for more of it, and in the case of an unpleasant feeling is to push it away, to be rid of it. And in our ignorance, there is no gap. I was taught that as one meditates, as one's awareness increases, one's mindfulness develops, so this gap begins to open up. And I think Dante describes this gap as the battlefield of the spiritual life. It's where, in dependence upon particular feelings, strongly conditioned and habitual responses begin to arise, and where, with awareness, we can decide either to follow their imperative and react with greed and hatred, or we can merely watch their arising and let them pass. And by not giving them energy, they cease. This is the cessation of the third noble truth. So it's not for nothing that the Buddha declared, if a man should conquer in a battle 1,000 and 1,000 more, and another man should conquer himself, his would be the greater victory. And not only was this gap the arena, the battlefield for the whole of the spiritual life, but it was also where the spiral emerged. Gaps, spirals, I felt like I'd wandered into some miraculous geometric game. The spiral, as I later discovered, is a series of positive spiritual stages which lead all the way through disenchantment to dispassion to enlightenment. And this in itself is a fascinating and inspiring area for exploration. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go into it here. So, we've managed to sit in the gap, and through mindfulness and resolution, prevented mental states characterized by greed, hatred, and delusion taking hold. The absence, even if only temporarily, of these poisons leaves a space for something much brighter and positive to emerge. And the classical example of this principle, taken to its higher level, is what is referred to as the unconditioned, asankhata. So what is the unconditioned? The Buddha tells us that it's the complete absence, the complete eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion. It's synonymous with enlightenment, with nirvana. So the complete absence, the complete eradication of greed, hatred, and delusion, that's the goal of the spiritual life. Well, put like that, it doesn't sound very exciting. So we've got to engage our imaginations. What would it be like to be completely without greed, completely without hatred, and completely without delusion in our dealings with other people? What positive qualities would emerge in the space vacated by the three poisons? Love, kindness, compassion, energy, wisdom, contentment, equanimity, peace. And they would be these qualities in their fullest sense, such that they're beyond our level of comprehension at the moment. So our task in relation to the third noble truth, cessation, is to realise it. And this leads to the fourth noble truth, which is the path leading to the cessation of suffering. The Buddha says, it is this noble eightfold path and nothing else, namely right view, right emotion, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So our task in relation to the path leading to cessation is to develop it. And the first aspect of the path is right view. And what monks is right view? Knowledge of suffering, knowledge of the origin of suffering, knowledge of the cessation of suffering, knowledge of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is called right view. So this actually underlines the importance of the Four Noble Truths, their penetration and their understanding. They're often one of the first things that we actually learn when we encounter Buddhism. And we can often think, well, I know that. I've learned the Four Noble Truths. Let's move on to something a bit more exciting. But actually, they're fundamental. They're fundamental that we reflect, meditate on them deeply, more ever and ever more deeply. You know, that we actually come to sort of know them in all of our being. But one thing that I noticed in looking at the list of the Noble Eightfold Path is how much of it I was introduced to at an early stage after I went to the Buddhist Centre. So in relation to right view, I was taught about the Four Noble Truths and the Three Lakshanas, that is, that all conditioned things are impermanent and unsatisfactory and insubstantial. I was introduced to the Law of Karma, or in Bhante's pithy saying, actions have consequences. In relation to right emotion, I was introduced to the idea that maybe the baubles on offer in samsara haven't and never will bring lasting satisfaction. So I was introduced to the idea of renunciation. I was taught about non-harm and the intention of goodwill through investigation of the five ethical precepts and the metta bhava and the meditation. And this introduction to the five precepts also covers the limbs of the path of right speech, right action, and right effort. And I must say myself that with regard to the five precepts, it was a great relief to discover these ethical guidelines by which I could live my life. I think although I'd been a reasonably ethical person, that was by the standards of society. And sometimes those standards are maybe not so high. They're certainly relativistic, and they shift like the sands. I remember in the 80s, one of the mottos was, "Greed is good." You know, so and these are things that are promulgated, and eventually sort of just fall into the way people think about things, and then it's an accepted view and an accepted mode of behaviour. So for me, it was a great relief to discover the Buddha's ethical training, highlighting as it does the cultivation of kindness, generosity, contentment, honesty, and clarity of mind. I was taught about the four foundations of mindfulness, i.e. the body, feelings in the body, emotions and thoughts, and the objects of the mind. I was taught the mindfulness of breathing. So I was taught about right mindfulness. And through meditation, through practicing meditation, I probably encountered right concentration. And I remember particularly there was a class they used to run on Friday evenings, and I was very keen on meditation at an early stage. I don't know, probably like a lot of people, I had some very positive experiences early on. So, and they at the Brighton Buddhist Centre, they ran this class on Friday evenings. And for me, it was like the double whammy, because actually, not only was I going meditating, but it was actually keeping me out of the pub, which was habitually what I did. I used to go to the pub every Friday with my mates, and I think we had the same conversation for about 7 years. It wasn't really a conversation as such, but it was the same old stuff. And initially, it took me a little while to get off that, because I used to go to the double meditation and then run out and get down the pub for last orders. You know, but eventually, you know, it began to dawn on me, this is a bit crazy, isn't it? You know, I'm sort of, on the one hand, I'm developing more awareness and concentration, and then I'm losing it all, you know, with 3 pints of Guinness. Yeah. Yeah, so I was introduced to mindfulness, and I had experiences of a concentrated state of mind. I also came to reflect more deeply upon, you know, what livelihood meant, how one went about earning one's living, what impact that had on me, what impact it had on other people, what was the most meaningful thing to be doing with my time. You know, we spend, you know, probably at least 8 hours a day at work. Well, was it really meaningful, you know, for me to be sitting in endless committees writing, you know, notes of the interpretations of things, you know, by the elected members? Or could I have been doing something more useful? Could I have been doing something to communicate the Dharma? And these things take a while to unravel. Certainly the livelihood one is quite a difficult one, you know, but actually by going to the centre and actually encountering people who are living in a different way, you know, it began to pose those questions. So as I say, I encountered all of these things within a fairly short time of visiting the centre. So in no time at all, I was in effect launched on the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, which is pretty amazing. No messing about, straight in there, straight down to fundamental principles. Woof, you're on the path. You know, of course, we've got to develop the limbs of the path, you know, over years and years and years, you know, but just looking back at it, and I didn't realise it at the time, but I thought, that is quite amazing, actually. That is quite amazing. Within 6 months, you know, going to the Buddhist centre, you know, through the process of teaching, you're actually launched on the Noble Eightfold Path. But also what I encountered at the centre, and hopefully what we all encounter, was a care and concern for others, altruism. And this was so refreshing after being in a world which was often dominated by selfishness. And these Buddhists at the centre, they even had a rather grand term for this impulse. They called it the Bodhisattva ideal. So this is that the goal of the spiritual life is not merely to seek enlightenment for oneself, but to seek it for the benefit of all living beings. So we may experience this in all sorts of ways, particularly with regard to the patience and kindness from which I was treated by the people who worked there. But it was also the example of people just giving of themselves, you know, of teaching the Dharma, people supporting classes, people making tea, people cleaning the loos, people engaged in the administration, giving financially what they could. And all these people did this purely because they wanted to help in whatever way they could to spread the Dharma. So at the centre, I encountered and gradually got involved in a community whose whole raison d'etre, whose whole reason to be, was to provide the conditions for those seeking enlightenment. And actually, the irony is, it's the active participation in that community which moves one along the path. So moving from being a passive recipient of services, in a sense, I became a fully engaged member of the Sangha, the fellowship of those treading the way. Which brings me to one of the other things that characterised the Brighton Buddhist Centre, which was the warm friendship between people, united in a common aim, that something was being pursued which brought great meaning and purpose to people's lives. The most important thing in life had been discovered and was being fully lived. And actually, if I'm honest, it's the friendships I've developed over the years in the Triratna Buddhist community that have sustained me. Although I'm very drawn to study and meditation, and sometimes I have a tendency to define the Dharma life rather narrowly in those terms, it's actually the human relationships, the sense of community, common purpose and friendship which keeps me going. It's like if I look around the room here, I've got connections going back quite a long time with people. There's Arta Ketu, who I met on my very first meditation retreat. It was last century. That sounds good, doesn't it? It was 1997, but it's still last century. Fadra Shura, who we were on the same ordination course together back in 2007 at Gukkyaloka. And there's Arta Priya, who ordained me. And last but not least, there's Yarnotra. And he led the first Mitra study group with which I engaged. And his name actually means supreme wisdom. So by finding the Dharma, I really had hit the jackpot. By finding the Dharma in Brighton, I'd really hit the jackpot. So to conclude, the theme of the weekend is wisdom in the world and how this manifests through centres. And I guess what I've been trying to communicate is just what an amazing phenomena a centre is. It's an oasis in the desert. It's a beacon of light in the dark. As I've indicated, the Buddha defined ignorance as being ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. And it's this ignorance which just produces ongoing suffering. And that's kind of, looking back on it, it's quite scary really, isn't it? Because actually, where are you going to bump into the truth of the four, you know, of the Four Noble Truths? I mean, you know, you're probably not going to find it at work. You're probably most definitely not going to find it down a pub. You're not going to find it at a football match. And you're certainly not going to find it in Tesco's. It's just not going to happen, is it? So it's by actually, you know, going to a centre that we encounter this wisdom. And centres are full of people dedicated to living out the Buddha's teaching. I mean, it's just very inspiring. And what's so great about it is once we've discovered them, we can join in. We too can become part of that community dedicated to walking the path to enlightenment. We can participate in building the Buddha land. And we do this both by actively participating in the centre and by reflecting and meditating deeply on the teachings we receive there, by putting them into action. And we need to do both things. So with regard to the reflecting and meditating, just to finish off, I'll remind you what our tasks are in relation to the Four Noble Truths. In relation to the first truth, the truth of dukkha, dukkha's suffering is to be comprehended to the point of dispassion. In relation to the second truth, its origin, craving, is to be abandoned. In relation to the third truth, its cessation is to be realized. And in relation to the fourth truth, the path leading to its cessation is to be developed.